I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. How do people on other continents develop their opinions of the United States? From the way our president, diplomats, and military leaders present ideas about democracy? From the way our corporations behave internationally? A young person in Asia or Africa is more likely to get an impression about us from Jerry Springer reruns, a Martin Scorsese film, or Miley Cyrus video. America's image abroad is not a pretty one, says culture critic Martha Bayless. And there are consequences for the U.S. and our desire to see democracy and freedom spread around the globe. Martha Bayless and Midday contributor Sherry Parks join us for a revealing conversation about America's cultural exports. After the news from NPR. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us and making Midday part of your day. More than 7 billion people inhabit planet Earth now, but relatively few of them will ever get to visit the United States. Despite that, people around the world certainly have developed clear and strong opinions about the United States. And how do they get these opinions? How do they form their impressions of the good old USA? From television coverage of the Olympics? From the way our president or diplomats or military leaders present ideas about democracy and freedom? From the way our corporations behave internationally? What is it? The fact is, a young person in Asia or Africa is more likely to get an impression about us from Jerry Springer reruns or Quentin Tarantino films or a Miley Cyrus video. America's image abroad, formed to an increasing extent by our exported movies, film, and TV shows and music is not a pretty one, says culture critic Martha Bayless. And there are consequences for the U.S. in our desire to see democracy and freedom spread around the globe. Between 1989 and 2010, foreign sales of U.S. films and TV shows increased fourfold, from $3.6 billion to $14.2 billion, and it's growing. These days, Hollywood's foreign box office earns twice as much as its domestic one. And as I say, it keeps growing. That's one of the facts we picked up from Martha Bayless's new book on American entertainment's influence on world opinion, based on interviews with thoughtful observers in 11 countries. Martha Bayless argues that by allowing our chief cultural exports, including violent movies, reality TV, vulgar music, to serve as the nation's de facto ambassadors, the world gets a distorted view of American values. And this is important. The U.S. no longer shares the best of itself, she says, and that's a problem. Martha Bayless is a humanities professor at Boston College. She's the author of Through a Screen Darkly, Popular Culture, Public Diplomacy, and America's Image Abroad. It's published by Yale University Press. Martha Bayless, thanks for joining us here on the Midday Show on WYPR.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Also joining us for this conversation is Sherry Parks, Associate Dean in American Studies at the University of Maryland, College Park, and Midday's culture commentator. Sherry, it's nice to have you with us.
Nice to be back.
Martha, I want to start off with the phrase public diplomacy before we go anywhere else. Some folks might wonder, what does she mean by public diplomacy?
Yes, that's an excellent question. Public diplomacy was something the U.S. did a lot of during the Cold War. It had several sort of different parts. One was cultural exchanges, educational exchanges. Another would be broadcasting, the Voice of America, and the kind of broadcast that went into communist-controlled countries. It would also involve just telling America's story, as was the slogan of the agency that carried out a lot of this, the U.S. Information Agency. Just sort of trying to present a full and fair picture of the United States, its culture, its history, its politics, and what its people are like. And then finally, there was an element, there always is going to be an element in these efforts of what, you know, the dirty word for it would be propaganda. The more positive word might be advocacy or explaining and defending the government, the policies of the U.S. government. And that particular element doesn't mix too well with the others. But it tends to be present when the government is paying for something. But all in all, they did a pretty good job of it during the Cold War. And I do not argue that we should go back to doing it like that, because it's a completely different world that we live in now, in many, many ways. But at the end of the Cold War, we basically kind of quit trying. And I think we need to make some effort, and perhaps in a new way make an effort.
And the point you make is that whatever we were spending on that, that effort in the Cold War up until the 1980s into the 1990s has been far surpassed by the exportation of our culture via the media, the big media, films and television and music.
Sure, and with a lot of help from the U.S. government, I might point out. the Trade Representative's Office and the Department of Commerce treat American popular culture and entertainment as a pure commodity, and they say there should be no restrictions from other cultures about this because, after all, it's just a commercial product. Meanwhile, at home, the entertainment industry and filmmakers rightfully claim, and I would support their claim, that they deserve the protection of free speech because they're artists and they're engaged in expressive culture. But there's a kind of schizophrenic split between the legal status of our popular culture at home, which enjoys all the protections of free speech and expression, and its definition as a commodity when we sell it overseas.
We like to think that we're admired still in the world, that the United States is admired. So, Martha, let me just ask you this. When you conducted these interviews, I mentioned 11 different countries for this book, did you ask that question? What do you admire about the United States?
You know, I didn't really have to ask, because the fact of the matter is America still is admired in most places. But what I found people, many times in a rather heartfelt way, people would volunteer what they admired. And they'd say, you know, gee, these cultural exports, and there are good cultural exports, don't get me wrong. I'm a longtime admirer and defender of popular culture. I'm not scolding and scourging it out of existence. I've always written about it and admired it. But what people would say is, what happened to the Americans that we have always admired? And their profile of the sort of beautiful American, as opposed to the ugly American, has always been, seemed to me, repeatedly and consistently, it was somebody who has a hopeful attitude, who thinks that things can be changed for the better, but who is not naive or utopian or starry-eyed or, you know, deluded about what human beings are like and what human nature is like and what you're up against if you do try to change things for the better. So it's a combination of hope and prudence and sort of sobriety. What they don't admire, generally, I would say, is a kind of over-the-top, reckless idea that we can just change the world, that our latest technology is going to change the world, that we're going to liberate all the women and girls in the world, that America can just do amazing things, you know, overnight. We've seen in recent years where that gets us. And it's on the right and it's on the left. We both, you know, both sides of our political divide tend to have these kind of illusions about what America can accomplish in the world. But I don't think the opposite extreme should be cynicism or despair. I think we should return to this hopeful but prudent attitude. In the book, I call it the American ethos.
So what are your concerns? But you have grave concerns about what we look like to the rest of the world through our cultural exports.
Yeah. I mean, just to take, for example, I mean, one example that doesn't come immediately to mind for most Americans is the portrayal of our institutions. And I know I'm very aware that I'm talking to a station in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
And I recently read something by the Wall Street Journal writer Joe Queenan about why is Hollywood always picking on Baltimore.
Yeah.
And I could say, I think you tweeted it, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
And I could also say, you know, I'm from Boston, and Hollywood seems to be picking on Boston quite a lot lately, too. Both cities are sort of depicted as, you know, cesspools of crime and corruption and, you know, just nothing redeeming. And David Simon, the producer and creator of The Wire, which is a fabulous TV show, don't get me wrong, has said that he's cynical about institutions. And that's a very good phrase to describe the way most of our entertainment portray our institutions, no matter what institution you're talking about, whether it's, you know, the flawed criminal justice system, whether it's the schools, whether it's, you know, universities or corporations or, God help them, religions. It's always shown in the darkest possible light, the most cynical possible light, because that is what is considered artistic. And I compare this to a funhouse mirror. It's a kind of grotesquely exaggerated view of our own faults and our own failings. And I think Americans find this amusing, entertaining. They're turned off by it. You know, we have a variety of reactions to it. But we tend to know, as we go about our daily lives, that these institutions, a lot of them are very well conceived, like our political system is well conceived. It may not be working very well right now, but it's well conceived compared to some political systems around the world. And, you know, there are a lot of good people, decent people who do their jobs, who struggle all day to do the right thing and who make mistakes, but who are human. And all that side of American life tends to get airbrushed out of much of our entertainment. Not all of it, but much of it.
Martha Bayless joining us from Boston, Boston College, where she's a professor in humanities there. Her book is Through a Screen Darkly. Sherry Parks, since we're talking about a lot of this, we'll be talking a lot about the media, right? I've mentioned films, movies, and music here, and Martha has examples to cite for us as we go along. The one thing I wonder about is, you know, the tendency of people to use fictional depictions of things, the distorted ones that Martha was just describing, as social reality, and that, you know, most of us are advised in this country very frequently when you have this conversation, oh, it's just a movie. It's just a TV show. Don't you understand that's entertainment? You have to put it over here. Don't let it affect you. Don't be disturbed by how this might be presenting a twisted picture, a skewed picture of your city, your town, or your country, right? Mm-hmm. But people do this. People do take fiction for social reality.
Yes, they do. And, I mean, what they are responding to is that adults have the ability to know when they're making believe versus social reality.
Right.
But, I mean, there are lots of studies that show that when people don't know something in their experiential reality, they're perfectly willing to drop in images, even fictional images, and remember them as if they had experienced them. That happens domestically, and it does skew our idea of social reality. Heavy viewers of television think that the world is more dangerous than it is, even, you know, that Baltimore is more dangerous.
Oh, you get the question all the time about The Wire.
Right.
Wherever you travel, right. If you mention right. You're from Baltimore, that's actually the main question that comes up. Yeah.
Right. And this is what I call the grand contradiction of American media and society is that we have always treated the media as a social institution and protected it that way. But increasingly, that social institution has to turn a profit. So we treat it like the church and the state and the family, which often operate at a loss.
Mm-hmm.
But then it has to turn a profit. And what happened at the same time as when Martha identifies the end of the Cold War is that we de-licensed commercial media and the profits soared. And so you used to own a newspaper or even a local TV show. I mean, you didn't lose your shirt, but you also didn't become a millionaire. And that changed when the licensing procedure and the social responsibility that went with it went away. And we show ourselves our worst selves. I do think that the mass media do pick up something that's going on in the society. Certainly, they don't pick up everything, and they often don't pick up the best parts of the society.
Well, that's the point Martha keeps making. Martha, in fact, if people told you this in interviews. The people you interviewed, some of them, you know, had an awareness about what's good about the United States, and they actually said to you, "You're not presenting what's best about your country."
Yes, that's true. That's true. And it's hard to. Let me give you an example. A lot of the people I met overseas, I have sent them, you know, here's my favorite movie. Here's, you know, because they wanted me to sort of fill out the picture from the kind of thing that they were getting just through the commercial market and, of course, all the piracy that goes on. And one of the programs, TV shows, that I recommended to people overseas was Friday Night Lights, which is went on for like 5 seasons about a football team in Odessa, Midland in Texas,
mm-hmm.
based on the book and the film of the same name. And the portrait of the coach in that film and his wife, she's a guidance counselor in the school, he's a football coach, is to me the only portrait that I can think of sustained over a long period of time of good, decent people. I mean, and he is not a boring character. He's not a prude. He's not preachy. He's a very cool guy. You see him working with the young people. America's full of people like that. And I've told people overseas about this show, and when they've been able to gain access to it, I've said, you know, it's about America. It's about race and religion and sports and competition and young people trying to find their way and the middle class getting squeezed and all those themes that we know so well. And it's a beautiful program. And I got an amazing response from people overseas just on that. It was a portrait of America that made sense to them because it seemed very human. And a lot of our entertainment doesn't seem human to other people. They watch it as sort of like a voyeuristic, you know, look at these crazy Americans, but it doesn't come off as human in a way that they can relate to.
A number of things stopped me in the book. Right in the introduction, you describe a man, I forget what country you were in, Martha, who said 50% of your fathers molest their children?
Oh, that was a woman I met in Cairo.
That was a woman, okay.
Yeah, she was a poet I met at the Women's Memory Forum in Cairo. And she was actually from Iraq. She was in Egypt at the time. And she asked me, is it true that 50% of American fathers sexually molest their children? And I said, I don't think so. Where did you hear that? Or something like that. And she said, well, if it's always on the TV talk shows. And if it's not true, why are they always talking about it so much?
That example stopped me. Sherry, yeah.
Yeah, and I certainly am not about to apologize for American media either. The two things that I think undergird this discussion, one, that there actually is a profit motive for violence and sex on television. You can write a very interesting, complex character, or you can throw in a car chase or violence or sex. You can take a mediocre script and pull in an audience with that. So the industry knows this. There's actually a profit motive. You don't have to hire the great writer who's complex and difficult to deal with. You can hire a mediocre writer who's okay and throw in that in and make the same money. And that's part of what, and you made in the introduction the idea that most of the profit for films are made overseas. You try to make back your investment domestically so that the rest is just profit. Violence and sex particularly translate well cross-culturally. It's easy for people to understand what's going on. So there's more of that. In part because you don't have to explain American culture for the audience to understand it, and we've let that go.
Mm-hmm. Martha?
Well, there's a lot of truth in that, but there's a couple of things that I would set against it. The first is that I've been thinking about commercialism and culture for a long time, and my sense of it is that if it were that easy to make a profit with dumb material that's just violent and saturated with titillation and so forth, then every show and every pop song and every hip-hop track would make money. And they don't. So it's not quite that simple. And of course, you're right that that the profit motive drives the entertainment industry, but it always has. And in the past, the profit motive was the reason why they had the production code and restraints on pop culture, because they knew the public didn't want to see things that were offensive to the public. And in fact, that same dynamic is at work today in the world. This is the one notable exception to what I'm talking about, and I think it's very telling. The film industry makes the vast majority of its profits through these big special effects blockbuster films. You know, like Frozen now would be a perfect example. I will bet you Frozen will make hundreds of millions of dollars overseas. Now, I would also challenge you to find the sex and violence and nastiness in Frozen. There isn't going to be any. And that's true of almost all of the big blockbusters that are the main revenue source for Hollywood. Without those films, Hollywood would not exist. It wouldn't have the money to make more of those films. And those films are where it makes the vast bulk of its money overseas. And what that tells you is a couple of things. One, that, you know, one of our big cultural exports is really not that offensive. But two, that Hollywood quietly kind of still engages in a kind of self-censorship when the money's at stake. you know, in order to get into China, in order to get into India, in order to get into Africa and Latin America, they pull back on the worst stuff. But then I would add, you can't sink into complacency because people watch TV, and TV channels, satellite TV channels, not to mention the internet, are full of all the other stuff that we've been talking about.
Well,
so it's a complicated picture. It's really hard to kind of sum it up, I know.
Well, we have more time ahead. Go ahead, Carrie.
I just want to clarify. I was actually making the point that a movie with a mediocre script and violence and sex is cheaper to produce.
Right. So mm-hmm. I was thinking of reality TV. Reality TV is very profitable because it's cheaper to produce. We'll take a break here and come back and talk some more with Martha Bayless, who's joining us today from Boston, author of Through a Screen Darkly, Popular Culture, Public Diplomacy, and America's Image Abroad. And if you've been abroad and you have some impressions to share with us about America's image there from people that you met in other countries, we'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear your stories about the questions you were asked about American culture when you visited there, about movies, film, music, any of it. Sherry Parks joining us, of course, is Midday on Culture. You can reach us at 410-662-8780, toll-free long distance, 866-661-9301. No, 09. I keep messing this up. 866-661-9309, toll-free long distance, and our email address, midday@wypr.org. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here with Sherry Parks, Midday's culture commentator, associate dean in arts and humanities at the University of Maryland College Park. And we're joined today by Martha Bayless, who's at Boston College, a professor in humanities there, a culture critic, and author of Through a Screen Darkly, Popular Culture, Public Diplomacy, and America's Image Abroad. An email from Jen in Baltimore says, I studied abroad in 1997. I was often mistaken for a Canadian because I am a brunette. It was assumed Americans are all blonde. Once other students learned that I was an American, they asked how many guns I owned and if I had ever witnessed a murder. At that time, their main source of American culture was Baywatch reruns. 410-662-8780 is our phone number here. Sherry, I have a question for you. America as cultural empire. Do we see ourselves as cultural empire, versus a traditional empire, which is based on conquest and geography and all that?
Well, there are two parts to that question. Are we an empire?
Yes.
And do we see ourselves as
yes.
an empire?
Yes.
We are a cultural empire. Our major export, as you've both said, is culture.
Mm-hmm.
And with that culture comes American influence and imagery. We are a cultural empire. We have not, for the most part, been a traditional empire in terms of conquest of geography and land. But very pointedly, we know that our media, we've known, the State Department knows, USAIA knows, most people in the media know that when we export media, we're not just exporting entertainment, we're exporting American values and an admiration, until very recently, of the American way of life. That's a type of ideological empire.
But we agree that it's coarsened. What we export certainly has coarsened over time, right? Would you agree with that?
It has coarsened. At the same time, it's diversified. There are voices
All right.
that
There's
are there.
There's more, as Martha was saying, there is more diversity, but also, well, what's the downside then? I guess I want to know from Martha what the consequence is. We have this idea, stated idea, that democracy and freedom is a good idea, something we should share with the rest of the world. That goes back to Benjamin Franklin's time, I guess, to the founders. But what about that? What are the consequences for those ideals in terms of what we export culturally?
Well, I guess I would jump in and talk about one of the things that I think a lot of Americans think America has the right and duty to export now, and that is our notions of women's rights and gender equality. And I have this image in my mind of how that works, which is you have someone like Hillary Clinton or Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times or his wife who have written extensively about the oppression of women and so forth in other countries around the world. And you have that person up on a podium giving a talk. And everyone listening, the Americans who are listening, are thinking of, you know, our daughters, our wives, our mothers, our aunts, our cousins, our friends, who, you know, have the freedom to get educated and join the professions and have certain legal rights and so forth. But on the screen behind the speaker, on the screen behind the podium, you have Miley Cyrus, you know, doing her little twerking thing. You have all kinds of images of American women. Of course, there aren't any older women in the media, so it's all young women, all of whom are sexually voracious, all of whom could give a damn about their families, could give a damn about anything that has even remotely to do with what most people around the world think of as women's duties and obligations, and who are just out of control. And I hate to say it, but that's how it looks. And it affects people in the Peace Corps. It affects young Americans overseas. Your caller is not the first person I know who... I know young women who said they were Canadian in order to avoid getting hit on. And I know young African-American women who've been overseas who are constantly being hit on because of the way they're depicted in some hip-hop videos and that kind of stuff. So in that realm, which is a very heated and contentious realm right now, I don't think we're doing ourselves any favor by depicting our sex mores and our families, or lack thereof, and our young women in particular, not to mention our young men, as out of control. I mean, youth has its problems and its tendency to get out of control, but that's not the whole picture, but it is what other people see.
Is it possible, given what Martha said, that people see these depictions in the media that we export as liberation, sexual liberation, political liberation, economic liberation? Sherry.
Well, I think there is an element to that. I think hip-hop is an interesting example because it is something that is an American form, that we a completely American form that we have exported. In the United States, hip-hop has become very commercial and very sexual and very violent. We export that. At the same time, there is domestically created hip-hop in other parts of the world that is very political and funny. And so there's this countervailing force of when you export the form, but then leave some room. And there are cultures like Brazil and South Africa and India who are taking American forms, and they have enough capital to create their own messages.
They're taking something good from it, meaning.
Right,
the word liberation, then, is in there.
Exactly.
Right?
Freedom
of expression. Oh,
and I'm not arguing at all that there has been a coarsening and that we export way too much sex and violence. We watch way too much sex and violence ourselves, and it has done those same things. You know, young black women get hit on at the same rate in the United States. And in the United States, at the same time, I think it's important to understand how complicated this is.
It is. Martha, before we let you go, then, I just, in terms of those of us thinking about this geopolitically, in terms of America's stature in the world, you know, I started off by saying we like to think we're admired. A lot of us like to think we're still exceptional. But in terms of that, the big picture of that, is what can be done here, if anything? Does this need to be countered in some way? Do we need to be working toward orchestrating a counter-influence in the media?
Well, first of all, I should say that I do not take a position in favor of censorship. There was a time when the U.S. entertainment industry regulated itself through the production code and so forth, and also the government, the FCC, over broadcast media. But the point of all that censorship in the U.S., and most of it was self-regulation, was moral. It wasn't political. It's not legal in the United States to engage in political censorship. Now, that's happened, but it's not legal. Overseas, what's happening now, and this is why I'm against censorship, is in the authoritarian regimes like China, Russia, Iran, and others, moral issues are used as a cover for political censorship. That's happening in Ukraine right now. Where homophobic fears are being stirred up as a way of, damning the pro-democracy protesters that are going on. And this happens a lot in lots of places, you know, where conservative people with conservative social values, their fears, their sort of moral concerns are used to engage in political censorship. And because that's the pattern in so much of the world right now, I don't think the U.S. would make any headway in terms of democracy and freedom by engaging in censorship. But that doesn't mean we can't engage in criticism and, free speech and write books and say things that are critical of our own culture. And I think we've been cowed by Hollywood so that we're kind of afraid, because it's so uncool, you know, to say this really is rotten stuff. Believe me, I know. So I think one of the things we could do is export our own criticism and export our own debate and engage with other societies, particularly with young people, about, you know, how do they see our pop culture? And no, it's not really a picture of America. In my experience, that's a very lively conversation, no matter where you have it.
Yale University Press is the publisher of Martha Bayless's book, Through a Screen Darkly, Popular Culture, Public Diplomacy, and America's Image Abroad. We appreciate you being with us today, Martha.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to continue this conversation with Sherry Parks after a short break here on Midday. Your impressions of our country when you go abroad? No. What are the impressions you've encountered about our country when you've gone abroad from folks you've visited with and talked with during your travels? We'd love to hear from you. 410-662-8780. And do you think this is a problem, or is this a matter of just get over it, accept it? This is our culture. This is what we do in the United States. Lots of emails here to read and phone calls. A short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday on Culture with Sherry Parks. Dan Roderick's here. 410-662-8780 is our number. We'll take some calls here in a minute. Chip in Canton says, I'll never forget meeting a Frenchman on his first trip to America. He was so shocked in meeting Americans, saying that the people in France have the perception that Americans are all either cowboys or celebrities. I remember going to France the first time in the 1980s, and they were very excited about the TV show Dallas. And they didn't think that's how everybody lived, but they thought that was a lot of America. Charlotte mentions this in her email. She says, those of us who travel are ambassadors from our country. It is our responsibility to put our best foot forward. I'm happy to say that in all my travels, I feel I've been treated as an individual and felt very welcome. I remember the first time I traveled abroad, people asked if Americans lived like they did on the popular TV show Dallas. I happily corrected them. Our email address, midday@wypr.org.
I do want to say, so that people don't attack me, my colleagues, that people have been criticizing the media for a very long time, and particularly Black feminist critics have been saying many of these things for a while. They may not have had the same platform, mm-hmm. but there are people who have been saying
sure
many
they
of
have,
things.
But we have this argument ourselves in this country. Yeah. I don't have it enough, I don't
right.
think, especially
oh,
when it comes to violence in the media. But Martha's talking about, you know, it's exportation, and this is not something I've thought about very much, really, is it, how does this play in other countries? And she cites so many examples about, you know, why people get upset about the United States. They think we live a certain decadent, distorted way, and that is a distorted picture, despite the coarsening of our culture. Let's take some calls and hear from our listeners on this, get your thoughts and reflections. Ronald and Glen Burnie, we'll start with you. Hi.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
What you're talking about really is erroneous stereotypes of other nations, other cultures. And it's been my experience, and I've worked with foreigners practically all of my life, that they know more about America than the United States, than Americans know about people abroad. And so I would like to focus a little bit more on our own ignorance and let their ignorance be dealt with by their own methods.
I'm not sure. Are we talking about ignorance, or are we talking about the distorted picture of the country?
Well, I think part of it is the cultural empire, that we actually do create much of the information that the rest of the world knows, sometimes about itself, if you've traveled abroad and watch CNN.
Mm-hmm.
and other writers have pointed out that they have instances of people abroad knowing more about American news than we know about ourselves. And so what's really interesting, and we need to make this point, that has changed since World War II, is that there are many more places that have bureaus in the United States. And the hour prior to this show on Diane Rehm, there was a Russian journalist who mm-hmm. lives in Washington, D.C., has lived here for 18 years. And so there's much more reporting from the United States that's going on now, too. So the information flow is going
a long way from the Cold War.
Right.
I agree with that. But in terms of what people know about the United States, I'm not discounting what Ronald says, but I think that's a small fraction of the world's population. And when you think about 7 billion people, how many of them will actually visit the United States and get to know any of us, and vice versa is true, right? So the media is the dominant influence.
I think they're making the same point in a way that, the rest of the world has to rely more heavily on entertainment media than any other to figure out who we are.
Mm-hmm. And Martha Bayless is saying that it has become de facto our State Department.
It has.
It's public diplomacy. This is what this is what constitutes public diplomacy now. And not all of it's bad, but there is, you know, Jerry Springer reruns.
At the same time, the budget for the State Department has been shrunk.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. For that kind of diplomacy. Jason in Perryville, you're on Midday Next. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Dan. I lived in Russia in 2001. I was teaching at a music college in the Far East, in the Hotka, and I was invited to go to an English class. And the students were all excited because they had music that had English in it, and so they started playing it for us. And the band was rapping in Russian, but then when it got to the chorus was one English expletive said over and over and over and over again. And the teacher didn't know what was, even though she was an English teacher, I don't think she knew what the expletive was. I think the students did, and they were just smiling. They just knew exactly what it was. So I think what happens is there's the tendency for the lowest common denominator to be the thing that sticks. And especially with people who aren't questioning what it is that they're being exposed to or listening to.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, that's what rose to the surface when I went to a elementary school classroom in Russia was that. And I saw that often when speaking with people who hadn't really had a lot of experience with the United States was the lowest common denominator would come to the surface more often than not.
Jason, the story you just told us about the Russian rap song, these were how old were these kids?
They were probably about 9, maybe 10 years old.
Oh, my God.
What were they saying in Russian?
Yeah, what was the song about?
I don't know what the Russian song was about, but I think it was plain enough because the teachers didn't have a problem with it.
Right.
Then when they got to the chorus section, the Russian rappers were singing an American or an English expletive over and over and over again.
Isn't that interesting? All right, here's the American part of the song, and it's all F-bombs or something, mm-hmm. right? Jason, very interesting. What do you think what he said about lowest common denominator? The part that sticks is the outrageous part, right?
And that's the part that translates. I mean, you can get that. It's interesting because this story has both sides. There is license there. I mean, these kids are taking joy in the fact that we can say these words out loud now.
Right.
There's a type of freedom that comes with
that. It's the story
that.
You were talking about hip-hop in other countries.
Right. And that's I'm really curious to see how they balance that with whatever they were saying in Russian. So, but yes, it is cool. Of course, I'm sure it was probably highly sexual. At the same time, it has that American license for freedom of expression that we export as well.
Here's a comment from Tim on American culture abroad. The culture we export might create a bad image for us, but think about the inverse. Ask the average American what people are like in almost any other country, and you probably won't get a flattering or accurate description. After all, most people all the world over are pretty much the same, including that we only know what's right in front of us.
This is an interesting point because one of the things that has changed in cultural diplomacy and truth in advertising, we're looking into this at the University of Maryland too, is the idea of empathy. That rather than my American viewpoint being the best one, the only one, that I should spend some time thinking about what your viewpoint is and you should spend some time thinking about mine, which is a different equation.
Exactly.
And I think the idea around empathy has gotten much more traction in the last 5 years.
So empathy as part of marketing.
Well, empathy
it makes me
as
think of the Coca-Cola commercial during the Super Bowl.
Our empathy is as part of diplomacy.
It's part of diplomacy.
Yeah.
Another caller, Sherry. This is Vince in Annapolis. Thanks for calling.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I wanted to comment on two things. First of all, the caller, the music teacher in Russia, I lived in France years ago, and I had exactly the same experience with the song Rape Me by Kurt Cobain's group, whose name escapes me right now.
Nirvana.
Nirvana, that's right. And at the time, it was extremely popular. Everybody was singing it, and I just got there. I was shocked, and I asked you, did you have any idea what it means? No, but it had the imprimatur of American culture, and I think, the small circle of friends that I had that suddenly, all consulted their dictionaries thought it was hysterical that that's what they were singing and celebrating. The other thing I wanted to say is that in general, I've been in Russia, I've been in France, I've been in a lot of places like that myself, and I've always had always the same kinds of questions. Like when I first arrived in France, the first trip I took, I got there the day after O.J. Simpson did his big drive. Mm-hmm. I knew nothing about O.J. I knew nothing about, you know, I was in the air when it happened, so I landed. And over the next couple of weeks, all I got was questions about O.J. I had no idea about any of it, and all of it came through a filter of French media for me at that point. And the questions they would ask me, you know, do you know Pamela Anderson? Does everybody in America have a gun? All, I would say, highly filtered through a very complicated type of media environment. But I also wanted to go back to what Martha said about the Americans in general villainizing institutions. And I think that has less to do with Americans being dissatisfied with their institutions, although I think there's certainly a trend towards that, and more just the American celebration of the individual in general in fiction and television and movies, that we so appreciate the individual effort in America that often comes at the expense of something larger. And I would say that, you know, police shows, judicial shows, hospital shows, those all resonate with people because, by definition, it's the struggle of the individual against something larger. Hmm. So I don't think it's strictly that we are dissatisfied with our institutions as a whole so much as we so completely celebrate the idea of the individual struggle that it often comes at the expense of the...
Interesting. Vince, thank you for those comments. Sherry?
I think Vince is making an interesting point, but having read the book, the point that Martha is making is she's bemoaning an era where there was more soft control of the way we spoke. And, I mean, lots of us bemoan that.
Soft control of the way we present, you mean the media in general, all of us?
Well, when she talks about self-censorship, she mm-hmm. really wants the industry to go to a point where it has a level of taste and morality that is more pro-social.
Mm-hmm. To understand its power and influence, too. I think that's part of the purpose of the book here. What goes mm-hmm. on in other countries, by the way? I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but, you know, some of the other emerging economies, Brazil, for instance,
yeah,
India... even South Africa now. I mean, they don't have state-controlled media, but do they try to influence their media?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Brazil is a very interesting case in a way that I actually think is pretty interesting. With telenovelas, they've actually done their own research, and they have experimented with putting in pro-social messages into telenovelas, soap operas, but they're wildly popular.
Really?
And
well, how do they do that? They just influence the companies that produce them to do it?
Or collaborate with them. And so they put in, Disney and ABC have done the same thing. They just didn't keep as good a data. But Brazil, for instance, wanted to put in family planning information into the telenovelas. And they did a very interesting thing. They almost put a tracking device. At the same time, they gave characters names that were very unusual in Brazil so they could trace who was watching and how it happened. Hmm. And they found that as family planning increased, so did the use of these very different names. And so they've kept very good data. So,
that's interesting. It's domestic, right? It's the state working with the artistic production to try to influence social behavior.
Right.
Interesting, Sherry. Oh, wow. Chandra in Towson, we'll go to you next. Thanks for the call.
Oh, thank you so much for taking my call. Sure. I came from India, and so, of course, I was influenced by American culture, like rock and roll music and all that stuff. It was all good when I was a young person. I was trying to think, like, one thing that I wanted to ask in this context of this conversation is, lately I've noticed lots of my friends in India are Christians. They've always been Christians. I've noticed a certain certain divergence towards more radical form of evangelism, and then I dug more deeply into it, and all of a sudden I realized that Christian Broadcasting Network, CBN, and all these things are so powerful in the Christian communities in India that they tend to export a brand of American Christianity that, for me, living in the U.S., I find it very strange. So I'm just curious to know if the author or your guest can comment on that. We not only export regular, you know, popcorn and soda things, but we also export some religious stuff. So that's what I wanted to talk.
Oh, Chandra, before you go, I'm going to let Sherry answer that, but how old are you? I'm curious.
I'm 47. I came to the United States when I was 24 in 1991.
I was just curious, when you were 18, what did you think of the United States? What adjectives?
I thought it was great. I was listening to rock and roll music and, you know, reading magazines. And this was just slightly after the Cold War. So we were listening to Voice of America, BBC, and we always wanted to explore the United States and, you know, and then educational opportunities and stuff. So we had a very positive look of the United States.
All right. Thank you. Yeah, thanks for your answer. Sherry, back on his point about Christian broadcasting.
Well, and he's talking about what we call the electronic church, which is very different than the mainstream of American religion because it has elements that translate well for television. And, I mean, it's much more visual. I mean, it's much more emotional, and it translates. There are certain things that television particularly translates well and some that it doesn't. Talking heads don't really work really well. The best example is basketball versus baseball. Basketball works on television. I'm sorry. Baseball really doesn't quite so well. And so, I mean, think about the image of the you know, before, the nun sitting in the wing chair versus what we now call the electronic church. It just works better on television. And then that's what gets exported.
Email for you, Sherry, for all of us, from Peter. He says, one way to diminish the coarseness of American culture is to increase our knowledge of the rest of the world. Survey after survey shows many don't know where Canada, Mexico, Morocco, Pakistan, etc. are and don't really care. Dr. Parks just mentioned empathy. Americans have empathy for foreign flood victims when they have their 5 minutes in American media, but in general, we don't know or care about the lives of ordinary citizens of other countries. Depicting these more in American media and schools might make a small dent in our course and coarse and self-absorbed culture that we export.
Well, and it's a
very empathy.
He just made a very complex point. And I love your audiences because they do this. Because one of the reasons that the coarseness is there is to create excitement. And there's actually lots of excitement in the world. And if we tell the stories of real people going through real struggles, you have that same emotional element. I think that works even better. And he's right that when the American media, when the American audience hears or sees about people in the world, they care about them, but they don't get to see them.
Barbara in South Baltimore, you're on Midday Next. Hi.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I've traveled quite a bit, especially in Africa. It's almost exclusively in Africa, all over Africa. And I can recall a wonderful woman from Senegal said to me, why do Americans think that we all want to come to America? She said, we don't. What happens here is we need clean water, we need housing, we need health, and we need education for our children. If we were afforded those things, do you really think we would leave our mothers and fathers and all of our families to go someplace else? She said we wouldn't. And to me, that basically is one of the problems is that other countries don't have the basic things that people need for survival. Mm-hmm. And if they did, they would stay home and they wouldn't come here. And they would not come here. Not that I don't like it here. I'm an American. But I can assure you that there are places around the world and what I know about in Africa that do quite well, that people are doing fine. And if more of them were doing better, they would not come here.
Okay. Gotcha. A very good point to end this story. There's an assumption that we make that everyone does want to come here.
And we do.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Barbara. Thank you, Sherry.
Thank you.
Enjoy this conversation. I have a couple more emails that we're going to save, and I'll read on the show tomorrow on Friday of this subject. Certainly a lot of interest in this. Fascinating. Sherry Parks joins us once a month for Midday on Culture. She's an Associate Dean in Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland at College Park. She'll be back again next month. Thank you very much, Sherry. Thanks, everybody, for tuning into our first hour. We'll take a break here. It's Thursday, so where does lunch come from? The Veranda. Located in Hamden on 36th Street, serving homestyle Indian food, specializing in flatbreads and chaat. The Veranda now open 7 days a week for lunch, 11:30 to 4 p.m. Stay tuned for the news. We'll see you after that.